Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. This is John with Casa, and we're excited for today's discussion on Bitcoin security, the next 100 years. I'll quickly introduce our panel. We have Jameson Lopp, our co-founder and CTO, Ron Stoner, Casa's head of security, and our special guest, Dan Held from Kraken. Thank you very much, Dan, for joining us. So I thought I would kick off the discussion by talking about the absolute coldest of storage, cryopreservation. So imagine that the year is 2122. You're finally thawed out from your cryo tube. Is your Bitcoin safe? Or at least do you think your Bitcoin is safe? Take it away.
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and introduce the topic. I think a lot of people have probably heard about cryopreservation because of Hal Finney. Hal Finney being one of the original cypherpunks and a good candidate for Satoshi. He signed up with a company called Alcor, which does cryopreservation. Now, what does cryo mean? Is it like the movies where they're like, you know, in Star Wars where they're frozen like that? Or how does it work? Well, so the basic hypothesis is with cryopreservation, there's a hypothesis that we have the ability to cryopreserve an entire human and at a later date bring them back. Now, at first, that seems like sci-fi. That seems impossible. But there's a couple reasons why it could work. One, it already works at smaller scales. So when we look at things like sperm and egg cryopreservation, that currently works. The problem is scaling up cryopreservation for larger organs and bodies. So for organs, they're starting to get close with animal organs on cryopreservation. And that's a pretty, you know, that's a pretty large organic object to cryopreserve and bring back with no damage. And so we're edging towards that direction of it being possible for humans. And the basic bet is when you get cryopreserved, the chance of you coming back if you get buried in the ground is zero, and cryopreservation is greater than zero. So by no means am I saying that it will work or that it's guaranteed to work or that it's likely to work. You've got some shot at it working. And based on physics, it's possible. It's not plausible. It's not highly likely, but it's possible. It's certainly possible to do it, depending on how much damage has occurred. And so with cryopreservation, the basic fundamental tenet of that is that your consciousness must reside in your brain matter. And as long as the brain matter is preserved to such a high fidelity, and we don't know what high fidelity is required, but if it's preserved at a high enough fidelity, at some point in the future, we can undo some of the damage that was done to your body before you, you know, that caught led to your death, plus heal the damage from cryopreservation. So that's some of the basics, and that's the basic premise behind it. And when we look at storing wealth through time, though, so if you get cryopreserved, you might be in there for a while. And so I think the exciting part of today isn't necessarily spending a ton of time on if cryo will work or not, more of just assuming it might work and talking about the implications of that.
Yeah, this is a topic that I'm only somewhat theoretically familiar with. Actually, I was at a Bitcoin meetup in Athens a number of years ago where someone gave a talk about this topic, and I found that there was a lot of interesting game theory at play, or, you know, potential security models or potential incentivization schemes that you could come up with. And of course, this is the type of thing that I spend all day thinking about, is like, what is everything that can go wrong and what can you possibly implement to try to safeguard against those things going wrong? And this is a particularly challenging problem space because, you know, generally when we're thinking about security models or wealth preservation and whatnot, you're only thinking about the present and short to near term future and like what an attacker could do given, you know, different levels of resources that they're willing to devote to an attack. But like one of the many, many reasons why this is a crazy type of thought experiment is that we're now trying, if we're thinking about like Bitcoin key management over an indeterminate time period, we're trying to safeguard it potentially against attackers who have an unlimited nearly amount of time to try to break down your security model and get to the funds themselves. So there's certainly a lot of things that can go wrong. And I've probably spent several days over the past week or two thinking about this problem and have yet to come up with anything foolproof. But I think that, you know, kind of going back to what you said, like the whole problem that we're talking about, there's no guarantee that it works in the first place. So it's probably okay to have, you know, a good enough level of security, or perhaps even a variety of different storage schemes to try to sort of distribute potential failures so that no one thing is going to be catastrophic. So that if somehow you manage to thread the needle and come out alive in 1,000 years, then there's also a non-zero chance that you might still have some wealth stored.
Yeah, so there's a couple different, so the cryopreservation folks obviously are, or cryonauts, you know, they've been thinking about this as well for quite some time. A lot of them aren't Bitcoiners, which I find bizarre, but, you know, to each their own. And so the way that they've currently constructed it is that you set up a trust to oversee your body through time, which is really, really interesting because there's a couple of different tax implications as well, because technically, according to the IRS, you're dead. So it's technically a tax-free donation. Because when you're dead, you know, to be the recipient, you can't normally set up yourself as the recipient of a trust after you're dead. But anyways, you set up a trust to oversee your body through time. So, you know, if the preservation company went bankrupt, your trust could facilitate the payment of moving your body to a new facility, all sorts of things like that, which is really interesting.
Dan, I was going to say that gets, I was thinking the same thing, and that gets a little bit scary to me when I think about that, because I know that, you know, with debt, with mortgages, with a lot of financial instruments, they're bought and sold, you know, wholesale en masse for debt recovery and things of that nature. And when Jameson and I were talking about this, I'm wondering if there's actually going to be a perceived value based off of who the tenant of that cryo storage unit is to say what's their perceived value when they thaw. You know, are we dealing with somebody where they're holding potentially whale amounts of money? And in that case, are you then becoming the asset or the NFT that's being traded based off your rarity or perceived value?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple different components here. One, you've got like the trust that's set up through time, but that's obviously open to seizure by governments. You've also got issues, you know, as well, even with self-custody private key management. So here's a theoretical problem that the cryo folks have thought of. So let's say you memorize your backup, right? So you've got a 12 to 24 word seed, and you've memorized that, and you're like, all right, well, you know, you could think about it two ways. One, you've got your normal trust set up to resurrect you or to incentivize your resurrection to where you get resurrected first in the future and oversee your body. Also, so let's say you have that set up and you've got your Bitcoin as kind of like your retirement account in your head. Well, there's two issues with that. One is if anyone ever finds that out in the future, if they're able to bring your brain and body back, they're probably going to be able to parse through your memories and extract your private key. Which is a pretty bad problem, because that means they could technically just keep you in that cryopreserved state and slice your brain open and just extract the information without ever cryo resurrecting you, which means that you're still somewhat in this suspended state forever, or maybe they've introduced so much damage that you are technically dead now. And two, so one case scenario is that, you know, they're malicious and that they get access to your brain and slice it open to extract the information. Two is more of a fun game theory where you actually have the mnemonic in your head, you have your backup in your head as a reward for a successful resurrection, which means that, you know, maybe we never do have the technology to like parse through your brain in that sort of state to extract information in such a high fidelity that they'd be able to resurrect a mnemonic, but maybe they're like, you know what, we can bring them back. And Dan Haldana's body has a tag that says, if you bring me back, I've got 10 BTC in my head. And so the fidelity of the resurrection will have to be very, very high. Otherwise, the information in my brain will be lost, which makes me dead and also makes them lose their incentive. So there's a really interesting game theory with that.
It's the same problem for the uploader argument. you know, upload me to a metaverse, my mind, my soul, my being, my consciousness. And it's the same thing where you would have no control. You wouldn't be able to control the thoughts. That would be extracted. And in some instances, to take this journey, you are giving up control. You know, the saying today is memento mori. You have to die. Remember that. You don't get to take anything with you. And you can do trusts and estates, but generally that's being transferred to another physical living entity. So when we're taking this journey where we may be coming back, we're starting to approach kind of new challenges and security paradigms and systems that I haven't heard a lot of people in this space talk about. I've heard, you know, the longevity crowd, the anti-aging crowd, there's a lot of that. But when people are starting to talk about, well, just freeze me or upload me or do whatever, I'll be a robot, right? I'll replace all of my dying body parts with machinery and technology. I'll be a transhumanist. Well, what happens with all the exploits and everything that gets associated with that? And you still can't prevent certain things from happening, even if you are able to attain immortality or some level of robotic autonomy. The other things that I would challenge people to think about with this is, you know, there's a time where banks used to contact all of their customers and say, come into the office and we'll do a review of your account. And the purpose of that was to verify the customer, but also upsell services. So just because you're frozen, this technology is going to keep advancing. And there may end up being check-ins from time to time, or somebody needs to perform maintenance or updates on you to either refreeze you or to verify or to fix something that wasn't correct with the 1.0 iteration of the system. So I don't know that people are necessarily prepared for that either, because if you have that perceived value and you're being woken up to be checked in on, how are those conversations going to go? And are you prepared for that eventuality as opposed to the surviving 100 or 1,000 years and then being unfrozen for good? That may not be the option that's necessarily being presented to you when you wake up.
Yeah, it seems to me like there's also probably a lot of human rights issues here. You already mentioned, Dan, there is at least currently something of a tax loophole because you're legally dead. I'm wondering, though, are you familiar with the Babaverse series? It actually exposed an interesting potential issue, I think, with digitization of consciousness and this long-term cryopreservation stuff, where it's a dystopian future in which basically governments have passed laws that deemed that cryopreserved people were not citizens and didn't have human rights, and they essentially became the property of the companies that owned them. And these companies eventually monetized them by essentially turning them into AI that they then embedded in other devices and spaceships and stuff. And so they, you know, essentially became slaves in a digital sense.
Yeah, there's all sorts of weird game theory stuff too, where have you guys ever heard of Rocco's Basilisk, where folks say, you know, if you don't help an AI become sentient, then the AI might come back later and haunt you. And so some people that are really freaked out with cryopreservation get really scared about it, because they're like, well, what if like a malicious AI, you know, takes these bodies and tortures you in some degree, you know, brings you back and then brings you back to torture you. And I think my thoughts on that is, why would a machine spend all that energy just to do something so silly like that? I don't think machines are exactly just motivated by such cold revenge that they'd go resurrect millions of humans just to torture them. I think that's very, very silly. But yeah, there's certainly some interesting things as well of like, you know, when it comes to portfolio construction, how would you even go about constructing a portfolio? Let's say the government seizure of assets and wars didn't exist, right? Because those add a lot of variability to this. And I know that's a lot of asset security through time, but let's just say there wasn't, right? Like, how do you even construct a portfolio that performs over that much time? I mean, in a way, do you need to have some active management of it? You know, like for example, if a quantum computer came out, the Bitcoin protocol, you know, there are quantum proof algos out there, and Bitcoin could upgrade to, you know, be secure against it. You know, there's moments like that that happen over very long time horizons, maybe 50 or 100 years. And, you know, there actually is kind of a case for not active management of your portfolio, but I think as Ron put it, like somewhat of updating your systems. I mean, I think Jameson, you've had a great article on this, like bit rot. You know, for example, your hardware devices are not going to last that long. You definitely have to have it on metal, perfectly. You know, for me, I like CryptoTag, and they're one of my sponsors, but it's made out of titanium. You know, crush proof, almost fireproof, and all these sort of things. But when you think about those 100-year, 1,000-year durations, it has to be on something lasting, and you almost need some sort of active management. I mean, there is, by the way, for those who are curious, the way that your body is cryopreserved is actually very, very low risk and passive, which makes me very bullish on it. So the way that your body is kept cryopreserved is it actually doesn't get frozen. Like a cooling, and so your body glassifies in a way, which is very interesting. And if you look at cryopreserved organs, they don't have, like, there's not frost on them, and so this preserves some of that cellular damage that occurs with some of the cells rupturing due to the freezing process. Some of them still they still get very much damaged, but there's a degree of damage that occurs. But cryopreserved bodies are actually kept in vats of liquid nitrogen. Liquid nitrogen is plentiful, cheap, and very stable. And you basically, what they do is they put these bodies, or if you just do neuropreservation, just your head, in these things called dewars, big, big, big aluminum containers. I think they're aluminum. They might be steel or something. But they put these bodies in these big metal containers and fill it up with liquid nitrogen. And liquid nitrogen evaporates at a pretty slow rate. And so they basically fill these things up once every month or so. And so humans can walk away for an entire month and the bodies are fine. And you can actually build much more robust systems. And Ralph Merkel, guy behind Merkel Trees, I actually grabbed lunch with him when I lived in the Bay Area. He's on the board of Alcor. And Ralph Merkel talked about how to build cryopreservation for the masses. Like, how do you make cryopreservation so cheap that everyone in the world who passes away in the clinical sense could be cryopreserved and maybe resurrected at some point? And at scale, using these techniques, using very safe, very long-lasting techniques. I mean, these facilities can last for forever. If you had and you can buy passive liquid nitrogen compression machines that takes the air and compresses liquid nitrogen out of it, and those are passive machines with no moving parts. You can actually have these facilities run without people there for potentially, 50 to 100 years, which is really cool. But that was a little bit of a sidestep there. I'm going off on a tangent here talking about the process. But, when you think about your money, though, how do you have your money on that autopilot? Or and I think Bitcoin is the only one that's resilient enough for that. I would want to hodl for 100 years, right? It's, if you were to pick one now, I think almost everyone would pick Bitcoin. As if you were to pick any asset out there, real estate, stocks, bonds, it's going to be Bitcoin. I still think there are some issues around some upgrades that might be needed given like a quantum computer or something else. But I'd be curious to hear your thoughts, Jameson, on stuff like that, like Bitcoin protocol upgrades that might impact your backup or private key management for that long.
Yeah, this is yet another one of the many challenges of talking about sort of far future looking storage. Because, we're talking about a protocol that's only 13 years old. And while the protocol and the community and the ecosystem around it, over the past decade, I think it has become clearer what the principles are that are held most widely and most strongly and are therefore most likely to be retained for the far future. These things like having forward compatibility and not making changes that basically break people's wallets or that would make their money unspendable for any reason. And, a lot of very thoughtful engineering and design goes into keeping these principles as we make changes to the protocol, because it is software, it is a kind of a living document, if you will, really a new form of communications and language just for money itself. We can certainly hope, and that would be a foundational principle, I think, of storing your wealth in Bitcoin for an indeterminate period of time. For at least for the quantum computing stuff, I think one simple thing you would want to make sure you do is not reuse any Bitcoin addresses. As long as you haven't ever spent from the funds that you have in cold storage, then those public keys should not be accessible. They haven't been put out on the blockchain. Therefore, they're actually protected by several other layers of cryptography that make even a quantum computer with sufficient qubits would be unable to brute force the private key, because it wouldn't even have the public key in the first place. But I think it all comes back to this issue of, I guess you could call it active management, but at least having some sort of guardianship that is able to make small tweaks. And the thing that really comes to mind for me from some of the multi-generational wealth management books that I've read, if you look at case studies of some of the longest running wealth management entities, these tend to be families. I think a number of them are like Japanese and Asian origin. The ones that have been successfully running for over 500 years, you know, many, many generations. A component to that is actually family and you know, raising your descendants with a set of principles that can guide you all as a family unit and continue to maintain a, you know, a successful posture from one generation to another. If you don't do that, then pretty much all multi-generational wealth management experts will tell you that your family will lose all of its wealth within one or two generations.
Jameson and Dan are kind of getting to the same summation that I came to, is that if you're looking for, you know, anti-aging, anti-death, longevity, either through any of the methods mentioned, you do have to put some degree of trust or custodianship into another person. And they need to do things like the protocol changes, the updates, security vulnerabilities. If there's major consensus changes with forks, or maybe it's not backwards compatible for whatever unforeseen reason, hopefully that does never occur. There's a lot of things that, you know, can potentially go wrong that we don't see today that you need to really encompass in this strategy for 100 or 1,000 years. Dan mentioned metal, and that's great, but are you going to know where that's physically located when they wake you up in 100 years? Is that location still there? Is the fire safe still there? Did the building burn down, or was it bombed in a war, right? We've seen some of that stuff today in different parts of the world, that when you're asleep and you're frozen, you don't have control or awareness of a lot of that. And what I would say to people is, Jameson hit it, I think if you're talking generational wealth and multi-generational, there's an incentive for your family to kind of keep that going. But if you don't have that multi-generational wealth, and you've put that degree of trust into somebody or into a family member that has no connection with you, what stops them from taking that wealth or plugging you or deceiving you? There's a lot that can really go wrong. And in that instance, if that's your concern and your worry, you know, we have inheritance today. That's as best as we can get, is these inheritances and these trusts. We can pass it on. We can ensure it's allocated for. But this is the new problem, is if we want to keep it and we want to come back, you know, there's no good system for this. There's no product. And as Dan said, we're still fixing the technology and getting to the point where we can prove that that's doable, and in a state where we can remember those things, those brain wallets and these weird security games that people play with themselves to try to protect stuff. But we have to get there first. And until we do, I think we are really highlighting some of these uncomfortable decisions and thoughts that people need to have when they're thinking about this.
Related to all of this, I was wondering, Dan, if you've ever heard of the domino of love strategy.
I have not. What is it?
It's really related to this multi-generational stuff, but it has to do with actually incentivizing your resurrection. And the whole idea is, this kind of goes back to what I was talking about, sort of familial principles, is that one way to try to incentivize your resurrection is to build a belief and value system with your family and your descendants that they should also be cryopreserved, because, you know, there is... from a technical and scientific standpoint, we know this is a last in, first out problem, where the people actually who are preserved last, like furthest in the future, will actually be the first to be revived because their bodies will be in better condition and won't require as much advanced technology to revive them. So you actually have this sort of reversal domino effect where you want the your descendants furthest in the future to be incentivized to work to revive their parents. And then once they are revived, the technology for revival keeps improving. You know, they will, because hopefully they love and miss their own parents, they will then do the same thing. And this sort of creates a domino effect, a chain, if you will. Of course, there's a number of assumptions at play here, but I think it's just an interesting game theory.
Yeah, so I'll kind of go off on my final rant here, where I've thought about these sort of structures for a while. You know, when you think about the facilities that you would store these in, like, so I would imagine a company, let's call the company Stasis. So Stasis is the biggest cryopreservation company in the world, right? And let's say Stasis commands like a massive market share, like 90% market share. So Stasis would probably create a strata of different storage techniques. You know, for example, you could be stored in an old nuclear silo with passive technologies to where they're like, look, you know, if there was an incident, it'd be 20 years until someone would need to go check on it. And they'd have active monitoring and it could withstand a direct hit from a nuclear weapon. You would probably want to have the bodies mixed. And what do I mean by that? You'd want to mix it based on country, race, language, religion, everything else. That way you would minimize your terrorist risk. You know, for example, maybe you mix presidents in with normal bodies and everything else to where you wouldn't have a circumstance where there's a concentrated group of individuals that could be targeted after they get cryopreserved. You know, to the LIFO, you know, last in, first out methodology, it's definitely going to be LIFO where the last technologies to be created to cryopreserve people will be the best ones. And those people would be resurrected first because it's the quality of their cryopreservation is so pristine. You know, when I think through, you know, when I think through how you could incentivize society or your family to do this, you know, the trust structures actually lead to something very, very cool and exotic. So let's say Stasis has an agreement with their collective cryopreserved humans, and let's say they hit like a billion humans, right? And Stasis is overseeing all of the trusts through time. Now the trusts are held in different multi-sig arrangements and everything else to where Stasis can't run away with the money or do something malicious with it, but they do have a good amount of control over the trusts and have the ability to move funds given that certain parameters are met. For example, the technology becomes available to resurrect someone. What's really cool is if Stasis decides to publicize the aggregate amount of value being held in the trusts to resurrect certain types of individuals. So as an individual who's cryopreserved, you can choose, hey, when the technique has like an 80% success rate, bring me back, or 90% or 99%, or, you know, because if you're already cryopreserved, who cares if you wait 10 more years to make sure the process is working right? Because the time difference for you is the same. And so you can specify, you know, when you would like to be resurrected or like to what degree of quality would you want to be resurrected in? If the technique is X, you know, works X percentage of the time. You can also create things that are really interesting too, where you can give free cryopreservations to people, given that they're test dummies, where you're like, look, you are going to be buried in the ground and you have 0% chance of coming back. So we'll do your cryopreservation for free under the stipulation that we get to experiment with the resurrection techniques on you. But when you look at, you know, the long-term incentivization model, the assets held by a billion people over time are compounding with no withdrawals, right? So let's say this company Stasis has a billion people in cryopreservation and the, you know, and they've got, you know, $30 trillion or $50 trillion dollar equivalent worth of value stored. And they can go basically build an X Prize for a cryopreservation resurrection where they're like, look, there's $100 billion sitting in our customers' accounts to resurrect if there's like an 80% chance of it working. And so that's an extremely strong incentive. And that incentive compounds over time because there are no withdrawals from this fund. This becomes the biggest fund in the entire world. And the fund incentivizes permanent life. or everlasting life. And so basically the fund compounds until the incentive is so great that humans deploy enough capital to go solve the problem and receive the X Prize award, essentially.
Interesting indeed. Though, of course, my pessimistic and adversarial thinking takes me to a worst case scenario of, you know, what if we end up with all the Bitcoin OGs cryopreserved, and due to the, you know, deflationary aspects of the currency, it actually turns into an issue where, you know, these days people are going to be complaining about like the top 1% owning like 50, 60, 70% of all assets. Well, what if it turns into like the top 0.1% of all assets of actually people who are even no longer alive own 90% of all of the wealth? That could also create some really perverse game theory of people wanting to then, you know, destroy those cryopreserved humans and basically, you know, destroy a large portion of the money supply because it would enrich everyone
else. Yeah, that's why you mix them with their parents. And then you keep the location, and then you keep the locations of their parents semi-secret, where you're like, look, if you want to go seize the wealth of these people, that violates your parents' clause and your parents' bodies will be destroyed. So, you know, if we discover that, you know, you could, the game, you become a company of that size, becomes bigger than the Dutch East Indies Company, becomes bigger than all the governments in the world at a certain level, because then it becomes involved in everything. And cryopreservation won't be a wealthy person's thing at all. Cryopreservation at scale, as described by Ralph Merkel and as specced out by him, he has got a great article on this. In back of the envelope math with today's technology, you can cryopreserve every person on Earth, and it would only cost a half a penny a year to keep their bodies cryopreserved. So cryopreservation won't be a wealthy person's thing. It'll be a standard operating procedure at some point in time when it's like, hey, you know, we've been bringing, you know, this is the logical step forward. I mean, it is the logical step to do, right? You have a 0% chance of coming back if you get buried. You've got a greater than 0% chance of coming back if you're cryopreserved. And within the realm of physics, it's definitely possible that it could work. But yeah, I think that you become so massive and so intertwined with everything that the negative game theories, yes, could exist. But there's not one facility. There's thousands of facilities across the world, and they're mixed with all sorts of peoples and nationalities and everything else. And, you know, you have some pretty strong, you know, game theory and incentives that could combat that, where you're like, you know, you could destroy your family's legacy or forfeit their trust if you were to act negatively against the process. But yeah, no, it could definitely go south, though. I mean, there's most ways it will go wrong. Let's put it that way. I'm not that much of an optimist, but I still think there's a good chance it could work.
There's no good multi-signature system for the living and the dead to coexist yet, but I imagine there will be at some point.
And I hope Casa develops it. And guys, appreciate you having me. I only had 30 minutes today, but this is a fascinating topic. As you guys could tell, I kind of geeked out on this. A lot of people get weirded out by it. It's a very strange, you know, there's a lot of like different dimensions to this about consciousness and cryopreservation and ethics and morals. And 30 minutes definitely wasn't enough time to cover it, but maybe we do V2 some other time. But I appreciate you all having me, and thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Dan. So we'll continue the discussion a little bit. So something that we haven't really covered yet is the prospect of time locking. Jameson or Ron, would you be able to explain whether this is a viable strategy?
Yeah, you know, time locking is actually something that comes up pretty frequently, not even, you know, with regard to this afterlife issue, but we have people who ask, you know, how can I time lock my funds just to make sure that A, I don't do something stupid like panic sell, or B, that you know, even if I'm somehow being coerced, that there's absolutely nothing that I can do or anyone can do, because the funds are you know, literally locked by the protocol. There is no one in the entire world who has keys that can possibly move them until a certain point in time. And, you know, we've been kind of pushing back against implementing time locks for a while because it creates a lot of issues, both with recovering your wallets, because now you're putting non-deterministic data into your locking scripts, which is going to break your deterministic, you know, seed-based backups. And secondly, because if you really think about the game theory of what happens to time-locked funds if an attacker gets your private keys, then it never ends well. And the reason why I say that is because while the time lock will successfully prevent an attacker who gets your keys from spending the funds until that point in time, once that time arrives, what's going to happen is, depending on who has the keys, you know, perhaps the attacker has a copy and you still have a copy, then you enter into this race to the bottom, where essentially you would both be looking to broadcast transactions and probably doing replace by fee on those transactions to incentivize miners to confirm a transaction that basically sends all the funds to a new address that only you own. Well, you know, what's going to happen? The attacker is going to be happy with getting absolutely any amount of that money. And so I would expect that, you know, both you and the attacker would be continually replacing the transactions with higher and higher fees, trying to bribe the miners, and of course, lower and lower amounts of the actual funds eventually going to yourself. So even I think if you did end up getting your funds back, it would only be a tiny portion, if anything, because of the sort of race to the bottom game theory that results.
The other concern I would have with that, we did a April Fool's post on the CASA blog, on blog.keys.casa.casa.centurion, and it was a product, 100-year multi-sig time-locked solution so that when you're in cryo, your family can't get access to your keys. That's exactly, you know, what's going to happen. I think there's way too many situations and scenarios that when you wake up, you may not be apt to deal with. The one I would be immediately concerned about is, what jurisdiction am I in? What is their local laws and what is their local tax policy? Because if I've been frozen for quite some time, or I've locked my keys for quite some time, I don't know what the lay of the land or what that situation looks like when I come out of it on the other side. And as Jameson said, I might be able to recoup some, but who's to say, you know, we haven't seen some massive crypto tax, or, you know, things haven't gone wrong in that case. Hopefully not. I'm hoping for the inverse. But these are the questions I want to ask myself that people worry about today. And I don't think they extend that time frame out 100 years or 1,000 years and say, well, these are the same concerns I have. What does it look like now? And it's very, very hard to answer those questions. So by time locking, all you're doing is guaranteeing that you're setting yourself up to handle that situation and figure out what you need to do when the shit does hit the fan.
It's also a question of flexibility, right? So we kept harping on this issue of having, you know, guardians or managers who are able to stay apprised of the situation with the ecosystem or the world at large, and if needed, make adjustments. When you're time locking, let's say you're time locking multi-signature setup, this actually prevents you from making changes to that key set. And so, you know, one of the very valuable features that we have in CASA is the ability to rotate out one of your keys. You know, if for any reason you believe that one of those keys has become compromised, we make it very easy for you to replace it with a different one. But if you think about it, if you've put your funds into this super cold storage that's time locked, then you can't even make those type of adjustments. You can't manipulate the properties of the key set. And so in a way, it actually makes your robust distributed key set somewhat more brittle, because if attackers start chipping away at the pieces of your key set, you know, they now have a really long period of time at which to slowly compromise your key set one key at a time. And meanwhile, you're not able to do anything about it, and you're not able to Think of it as kind of like fainting away, you know, parrying the attack, if you will, by replacing keys with new ones that you know are not compromised.
Thank you. The next question I have is about the digitization of consciousness. If you were going to upload your consciousness, say, in perpetuity, and you were going to embark on this right now, how would you go about it? Are we talking about a smart contract platform or some sort of complex AI?
I think if I had to do it today, I would just want a one-to-one copy. When you get into forensics and data, there's some differences between file types and metadata, and was it a file level backup or a block level backup? And that's all just it's difference on how the data is being stored on the back end. I would want to get as close to like as a one-to-one raw data block level backup of my memory and my consciousness as I could. But the only way I would go doing that is if I had some sort of encryption or control where somebody else could maintain that, somebody I trust or somebody in my family. The only reason is that I do know things in my head. I do know the locations of seed phrases and items and things that were very sensitive. So if I'm uploading my conscious one-to-one and it's in clear text, what stops, you know, that theoretical company from going through their backups of their files and saying, let's see what's in Ron's head or what Ron experienced in his life, because I'm bored service tech and, you know, it's late at night. We see that people, that happens with your credit card bills, with cable bills, people of all industries go snooping sometimes. So I would want to make sure that I retain some degree of control. Otherwise, I think I'm not moving my conscious forward. Sometimes the best move is to not make a move. And if I'm not confident in that technology yet, where I'm not confident they're going to be able to bring me back and recover my funds, I think at that point I'm going to have to cede control and hope that somebody else in my family or my lineage is ready to enjoy that.
Yeah, I mean, the problem right now is that we don't really understand the brain that well. We don't really understand what makes you you. We don't know what the exact data structures are required in order to perfectly recreate your consciousness. What we do know is that, you know, simply mapping your neural pathways is not sufficient. That there's far more to it that really goes down to the probably molecular, if not atomic, level. And so, like, this is why people are currently using the same substrate to preserve the data. And by substrate, I mean your physical brain, is because whatever the level of complexity is in your physical brain that needs to be replicated, reproduced, or simulated somehow digitally, we aren't at that point yet. We're still missing pieces of the puzzle. And, you know, this is the hope, is that if you cryopreserve yourself well enough, that hopefully there has not been data loss or corruption of that substrate. But who knows? I mean, maybe it's such that as soon as you die, even if you get cryopreserved within a day or within a few hours, maybe there has already been sufficient corruption of that substrate. You know, we won't really know the answer to that problem, I think, until we're at the point that we can actually read the data and then recreate the consciousness. But that that's certainly the bet, is that if you do it fast enough and well enough, that hopefully there is a period of time shortly after your legal death that you're still able to, you know, snapshot that data.
Thank you. At this point, I'm going to open it up to Q&A, but while we get some requests in the queue, I'm going to throw up one question. So, James, you've been working on this project of getting old versions of Bitcoin Core to sync from scratch. From all of your research, do you think that there is a way to run a node forever?
Well, this is where the research gets kind of complicated, and also it turns into a bit of a philosophical question of like whether or not Bitcoin has ever hard forked and whether it's always been forward compatible. is that what we found is that for a number of the really early versions of Bitcoin Core, basically the 0.7 and earlier, they had an issue with the type of database that was being used by the node. And these versions of Bitcoin Core never ran into issues during the periods during which people were actually running the versions. However, now, 10 years later, we find that due to the increased data volumes and complexity of the blockchain and all of the database operations that end up happening in the nodes actually grind to a halt because there are some sort of default limits on the database operations. So could or is it likely that something like that will happen again 10, 20, 30 years from now? I think the answer is yes. This is a reason why software needs to be maintained in perpetuity, is because the world is a complicated place. And even though Bitcoin Core developers have done a very good job of removing as many dependencies as possible from the software, there's still other libraries that's using, and there's things that happen in the world at completely other layers, basically affecting computer science and cryptography and security best practices in general, that make it such that if you are not continually maintaining and applying security patches and updates, unmaintained software tends to become exploitable. And this is even basically true at the level of math and cryptography in general, is that over long periods of time, cryptographic functions end up becoming weaker and vulnerable because our understanding of cryptography improves. And this is just the name of the game of security in general. It's a never-ending war. So while you'll probably be able to run a node for many, many years, it's also probably only a matter of time before that node itself becomes vulnerable in some way, just because our understanding of the space and the code has revealed vulnerabilities that were there all along.
I think it won't be if Bitcoin protocol itself it fails. I think it'll be all the associated infrastructure or hosting capabilities or DNS or TLS. It's very hard to keep servers going. And sometimes the servers at the most uptime are like the laptops that's on top of somebody's closet somewhere that they haven't touched in 15 years. The ones in the data center that have the drive recursion and dual power supplies and redundant power uplinks, those are a lot of times where you see the failures, which is why they have the five nines of service uptime and SLAs to show you who's actually doing it right and who's not. So like my concern would not necessarily be the code updates, because it's very easy to automate pulling down code bases and doing database migrations. But I think what's very hard is how do you replace a failed piece of hardware? How do you fix a cloud service that goes out of business? How do you architect for those types of things? So I'm going to go the inverse to say, I don't think you can ever run a node forever. I think you always are going to need some maintenance or some administration or a touch point being able to keep the ecosystem going. And there's nothing wrong with that. It just ensures we're doing it correctly.
Thank you. The last cloud bender, I added you to the stage. You have a question for us?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for this space. I read a blog from Jay Minson about retention of keys and the best practices. It's a very good blog, by the way. So question is about SSKR, which is also sometimes referred to as Shamir shards. The question is, how do you recommend preserving keys, the private keys, 24 words or 12 words, for a really long period of time by just putting the 24 word directly on a steel or titanium? Or do you recommend SSKR? And if so, how do you then preserve these shards? And do you also put these three shards or more shards in three different pieces of steel or titanium? What's the recommended approach?
Yeah, this gets pretty complicated, right? I would say I have not recommended SSKR to anyone. it's still fairly technical. I think that something like SeedZor is actually a lot more straightforward for non-technical people to use. And it's also, the nice thing about SeedZor is that it's essentially using seed phrases kind of on top of each other. It gives you this level of plausible deniability where each piece of it looks like a completely valid seed phrase in and of itself. And as a result, it's also very easy for you to then go ahead and be able to reuse any of these steel or titanium plates out there because you're still using the BIP39 word list. So I think one of the things that I mentioned in that seed phrase backup article is that, you know, if you are using SeedZor, the default is basically a 2 of 2 backup. I was told later on that it's possible to do others. It gets more complicated, and I think leads to problems where the average person might shoot themselves in the foot. So I would think the user-friendly, less technical, good option would basically to have multiple pairs of these SeedZor plates and then distribute them around in many different places so that, you know, none of them are a single point of failure.
And to add to that, I think distributing them around, that's different connotations for the physical world versus the ethereal world. And what I mean by that is I made the joke a little bit earlier about the life and death multi-signature product. But it's the same thing with SeedZor, where if I was going to upload, or we're talking 1,000 years, that may be something where my estate or the executor or the guardian of my cryo tube or whatever I'm in at that point, you know, has one piece of it and I have the other piece in my head. And that's the contingency, is we need to bring Ron back successfully so that we can get his part of the SeedZor and then he can unlock the wallet and do the final step. Something like that would give me a little bit more degree, I think, of comfortability than knowing that I had everything in one seed or somebody else had full control over it while I was in long-term storage.
Thank you. Frank, I added you to the stage. Do you have a question for the panel?
Hi, thanks for inviting me out, Jameson. And I just going back to the cryotherapy discussion that you had not so long ago. Would it be possible? I know you kind of talked about the brain and memory, but if it was possible to, in the future, scan each kind of nano segment of the brain, would it be possible for a company to be able to identify memory of that person who was cryogenetically frozen and then find out perhaps where they had their seed phrase hidden or where it might be stored?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't see why not. You know, I think this is one of the many reasons that I landed on of why it's very difficult to come up with a self-custody solution that works when you're dead and cryopreserved. The way that essentially I ended up thinking of it is, when you're cryopreserved, you are essentially a prisoner. You are in someone else's custody. They have all of the time and resources to do whatever they want with you. And one of the many problems here is that you don't know whether or not they'll be able to scan your brain. And I think you have to assume that they will, because eventually, if the technology gets to the point where you can ever be resuscitated, then they would have to be able to, you know, scan everything and be able to understand, you know, what makes you you, what makes this memory here. And so anything that you're keeping as a secret in your mind, whether it's a seed phrase that you've directly memorized, or even if you've set up essentially a treasure hunt that, you know, you've distributed your metal plates in these different locations, you know, that could also be retrieved by an attacker. And then they could leisurely take their time, going around scoping out all these locations and figuring out, you know, how to get the different pieces of your keys and wallet back together. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why it seems like it's better to use some sort of external solution, whether it's, you know, whether it's a legal framework based trust or a distributed multi-sig that is basically handled by other people, your heirs and descendants, and essentially, you know, something that is a bit more flexible so that they can also make changes over time if needed. But yeah, this is a very complicated type of model to think about, and there's a lot of unknowns, but I think I've written down and identified at least like a dozen things that could go wrong, and I don't see any one straightforward solution that will guard against every possible thing that can go wrong.
It hurts when you get scammed, or when I've seen people get rug pulled on various things that are out in the industry today, but I can't imagine the hurt and the pain when you get unfrozen after 100 years and realize you were scammed or rug pulled. That's really got to stink.
Yeah, I think one way that I've heard it described is you want to ensure that if you wake up in 1,000 years, you're a rich tourist, not a a poor person who's completely out of place. Because one of the things that we haven't talked about is that if you... Okay, so we're basically talking about time travel, but we're not talking about time travel back in time. We're talking about time traveling to a point in time, potentially so far in the future, that almost everything about society has probably changed. So if you wake up in a future 1,000 years from now, it's going to be similar to if someone in medieval times got cryopreserved and woke up today. They will have communications issues. They will have cultural issues. They'll probably have a lot of beliefs that will be considered, you know, savage or backwards or outdated or whatever. And they probably won't have any skills that will actually be, you know, monetizable, other than perhaps the fact that they're an oddity and could be some sort of, you know, sideshow attraction. So if you wake up 1,000 years in the future and you're destitute, you're going to have some major, major hurdles to overcome. It'll be, you know, I think far worse than what, you know, someone who immigrates to a new country today will have to deal with.
Thank you. Crypto Magnet, I added you to the stage. Do you have a question for the panel?
Yeah, I was. I'm one of the coordinators for the Des Moines Bitcoin and Blockchain Network Meetup Group, and I was wondering if any of the speakers here would be interested in giving a presentation over Zoom for us. We had Jamison Lopp a couple of years ago. He was outstanding, and I appreciate this conversation you guys are having on here.
Thank you. Yeah, if you'll send us a DM and we can chat.
Okay.
But I'll keep the discussion moving just for the sake of everybody here.
No problem.
Ignacio, I had to do the stage. Do you have a question for the panel?
Hello, everybody. Thanks for the space. I don't have any question right now. I was interested in the applications that could be built around Bitcoin. And I was wondering if Ethereum or other smart contracts, what in your opinion is the most areas with most potential? Thank you.
Are you talking about it within the context of long-term wealth security over the next 100 years?
Yes, the security of the ecosystem built around Bitcoin, such as Lightning Network, smart contracts, Ethereum, and so on.
Yeah, you know, there's very different approaches from these different networks. And I think it's not controversial to say that the Bitcoin as an ecosystem is a lot more conservative about changes that it makes. It tends to be more focused on security rather than functionality, whereas most of the what would be considered more feature-rich smart contracting systems seem to be focused on making changes at a faster pace, you know, evolving, adding more functionality. And that really always it leads you to questioning, you know, what is the long-term viability, you know, how long will they be able to do that? Now, on one hand, it means those systems are more flexible and they can respond to certain threats faster. You know, there's a number of occasions throughout the Ethereum history where various vulnerabilities or like denial of service issues were discovered, and they made fairly fast changes that were, you know, hard forks and basically not forward compatible changes. And, you know, that allowed the system to continue working and being usable. But, you know, when you're using a system for, you know, super long-term storage where you don't necessarily know when the next time is that you're going to be able to spend the funds, I think that's when you want to prioritize the thing that is more conservative. But, you know, it's really hard to quantify. You know, it's hard even to talk about this type of stuff with regard to Bitcoin, because we have a whole 13 years of history, and we're talking about problems on a time scale of hundreds, if not, you know, 1,000+ years. So, you know, this is all very speculative, and there's no way for me to really give a sort of quantitative weighting. It's all very hand-wavy and relative.
Anybody, I think you asked that question too, is going to give you a different opinion, depending if they're a tribalist, a maximalist, a shitcoiner, what their experiences have been, you know, if they were hacked, if they lost money. There's a lot of emotion that goes into this. And what I would say to anybody that's new to this stuff or is looking into it is, you know, read the white papers, read the use cases, understand why there's different types of coins out there, why there's different forks, why there's different versions of Bitcoin even, even though, you know, we should only really be recognizing one of them. And what I mean by that is everybody's use case is different. So I've had my own opinions, and I've talked to people in this industry that like a coin that I have no interest in because it has different settlement time and that's what's important to them. Or they use it because it's more privacy focused, right? It's got some privacy shielding features baked into it that may not be in other coins or protocols, or there's drafts or proposals to implement that stuff, but maybe it's not fully integrated on chain A versus chain B. So I've heard people actually give me some convincing arguments about why they like certain technology and coins, and it really comes down to the use case. Some people are proof of work versus proof of stake fans. Other people like settlement times or low transaction fees. And I'm not going to tell you that you're wrong for reading into one or the other. Everybody should do their research and come to their own conclusions. And as somebody that, you know, has worked for various companies in this industry and has gone back and forth, there's really only one or two coins that I keep coming back to, and there's a reason I keep coming back to them. So I will leave it at that.
Thank you. Neski, I added you to the stage. Do you have a question for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Good to see everyone. So yeah, I have a question. So a lot of my patients are excited about BIP-119, CLTV, and some are actually concerned. So James and Ron, like, was wondering if you could just give your take on this thing.
Oh, juicy drama. Okay, so I'm a fan. I'm actually a sponsor of Jeremy Rubin. I like the work that he's been doing. I like the idea of covenants. I'm not pushing for, you know, activation of any one thing at this time. My sort of take on the whole covenants issue is that Jeremy cares a lot about covenants, and a lot of other people don't seem to care much, or at least they don't seem to care as much to put as much effort into covenants as Jeremy has. So it's kind of, you know, disappointing to see sometimes how slowly the development process can be. This is not a new thing by any means. I think Jeremy has been working on covenants for 2, if not 3 years now. And on the plus side, there's been a lot more conversation about it, and that's what I think is needed. Need to keep having discussions about, you know, what the optimal covenants solution should be. I think we all know from previous consensus rollout stuff is that trying to rush anything is going to end up with people getting upset and bad things happening. But I can understand Jeremy's point of view of just trying to put some more pressure on getting more input into this issue. So covenants is interesting, you know, from a security model perspective of being able to, you know, be more descriptive about, you know, where your Bitcoin can flow to. I think we're going to need a lot more tooling to really be able to understand the ramifications of that. And, you know, one of my issues when it comes to, you know, creating logical flows for your Bitcoin that are kind of like escape hatches is that you then need to also worry about the security properties of whatever keys are securing the wallet that they're going to. So you don't even necessarily need to have covenants for something like this. We could fairly trivially, even today with Taproot and TapScript, create, for example, a degrading multi-sig setup where after so many blocks or so many years in time, you can then spend the funds with a different set of keys. Or even, you know, with a smaller spending threshold of your current set of keys. And this provides, you know, some interesting ways to get out of scenarios where you might otherwise lose access to your money. But, you know, I don't have a perfect, you know, silver bullet answer of like, we need to be able to implement this one specific workflow. You know, this is a much more, you know, generic tool that people are going to start building on top of. And so just like we see with other smart contracting systems, you know, people are going to make mistakes. They're going to use the tool to end up creating systems that actually have vulnerabilities or weaknesses. And, that's the name of the game when it comes to security, is sort of trial by fire and learning by failure.
I'm a person that's very appreciative of some of the drama and the infighting that happens in the community. And it's a weird thing to say. People are sick of it. They're exhausted. They're tired. In the early days of Reddit, it was Bitcoin versus RBTC, and they talked about colored coins and things like that. And then we saw Ethereum happen, right, in the RC20s. There was the small block versus big block, and soft fork versus hard fork, and user acceptance and all of this stuff. And what I would say to this is the fact that there's drama and that this is being debated is a win for Bitcoin. It means that consensus is working and that we're all adhering to it, right? If there's questions about things or ambiguity, we're not going to activate it, or miners aren't going to signal for it, or whatever the mechanism is at the time. And we need to answer those questions and get everybody on board and get a full understanding. So like, that's the beauty of this design and consensus and community, is that it's working, right? We're able to infight, we're able to debate these decisions. Whereas the flip side, I've seen, you know, DAOs that are running these decentralized organizations, and when you look at their snapshot page or their voting history, they've got 70 proposals where everybody just votes yes for every single one of them. And maybe those 70 proposals are good, or maybe they were written with well intentioned. But in my review of some of that stuff, it just seems like it's groupthink and hive mind, and everybody's kind of going with the flow, right? They're being the sheep. So the fact that we can have discourse and discussion and really get into the weeds and debate these types of things before we all come to consensus is a win, and I'm very appreciative of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's still remains to be seen what miners are going to do, right, when they vote. Yeah, I like totally agree with you. Is that just having those discussions, really, that's what kind of really matters. And but it also was fascinating to see that amongst my patients that a bunch of people became like almost instantly unstable and very concerned about BIP 119 CLTV. And yeah, so those discussions are productive. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, maybe people are just concerned or unnerved because it's, you know, creating some friction and drama. Personally, I would like to see, you know, more of the proponents of like the any prev out, which is my understanding is basically the main other competing potential covenant proposal. I just want to see, you know, them put more more pressure into, you know, dialogue and consensus building. There was, I think, almost nobody in the community was around for it. And so almost nobody ever talks about it anymore. But there was a really, really dramatic debate in like 2011 or 2012 about which of two proposals for what eventually became a pay-to-script hash was. And I think Luke Dashier had one and Gavin Andresen had one. And Gavin ended up getting his in, you know, arguably by being a bit forceful about it and sort of saying, you know, this is what consensus is going to be. So, you know, there is a very long history of fairly like ferocious technical debate happening around the Bitcoin protocol.
Thank you. Crypto for All added you to the stage. Do you have a question for us?
Yeah, how you doing there? I was wondering your thoughts on the Coinbase or the Coinbase wallet as a storage for your Bitcoins.
So you got to be kind of careful here because I think a lot of people, they have the Coinbase app for basically the brokerage and exchange, and you know they buy their Bitcoin there, and then they just leave it there. This is where you get into the whole "not your keys, not your coins" issue. You know, there's a lot of potential risks when you're leaving your money with a third party. Now, Coinbase also has a wallet, which, to my understanding, is just like a phone app. Basically, the keys are sitting there on your phone. And, you know, this is what I would consider to be like sort of the first step into self-custody. It's arguably better in many ways than leaving your money with a third party. However, now, you know, if all of your funds are sitting in some private keys that are on your phone, that's creating a whole new set of risks. So, you know, we do have one wallet that is architected like that within the Casa app, and our general recommendation, and in fact the app itself will start yelling at you if you have like more than $1,000 in that particular setup, because it's risky. You should only really have as much money in a single signature phone wallet as I would say you would carry around in your wallet in real life in cash. It's just a lot more ways to lose it. So, you know, once you start having a more significant amount of value in Bitcoin, that's when you need to look at getting, you know, dedicated hardware devices so that the keys are never touching an internet connected device. You know, that protects you from a whole new class of issues. And then once you get into having, you know, really substantial amounts of money, that's when I think it makes sense to start looking at multi-signature setups, where you're basically adding more resiliency and redundancy against having single points of failure that could cause loss of funds.
All right, thanks a lot there.
Thank you. And this is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us. Ron, Jameson, any final thoughts on the topic of cryopreservation and wealth security over the next century?
It's a really risky situation. There's a ton of things that can go wrong, but kind of like Dan was saying, if you don't even try, you're definitely going to fail.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think we're not there yet. We're building our way there, right? It's like year one of Bitcoin. We got to walk before we can run with this. And I would say for the people that are worried about this, that are considering it, you know, we can do inheritance today. So that is what's available, and Casa offers that type of that product as well. So if that's something you're worried about, that's the definitive for sure go-to methodology. But forward looking in the future, this stuff's fun to think about. It's interesting problems to work on. And I know we're not done talking about this stuff yet. We're going to continue this and try to figure out solutions. I look forward to the living person, dead person, multi-signature product.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Ron. Thank you, Jameson. And thank you to everyone who listened in. And this concludes our program. In the meantime, don't trust, verify. Take care, everyone.